funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's it like to grow up lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered in a small town? While older generations often assume that LGBT people have little opportunity to be visible and proud members of rural communities, my guest today has found a new and different reality for some of today's youth. Mary L. Gray is Assistant Professor of Communication and Culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. Mary, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start briefly by touching on your use of the term queer, because depending on the context, this is a word that can mean very different things to different people.
Definitely.
Will you talk about what the word represents for you and why you choose to use it?
That's a really good question, because I think the word queer is used quite a bit in university settings, and there's something actually called queer studies. And as an approach to thinking about sexuality and gender that perhaps doesn't fit within identities that we're familiar with, like heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual or trans identity in terms of gender. Theorists like myself, researchers like myself, have used the word queer to try and capture those identities and experiences that don't quite fit in what we're familiar with. So it has a very different meaning in university contexts in the classroom. For the young people I worked with, and I think this is where it crosses over, it also has some salience to them as a political identity. So it's certainly a term that's heard among particular, usually progressively oriented activists in the LGBT community. And for these young people, for some of these young people, queer is an identity that helps them navigate exactly who they are and what they're experiencing.
Okay. So just to clarify for people who are listening, you're using it in an entirely respectful way, different from the sort of disrespectful ways it may have been used in the past in different contexts.
Absolutely. And I think the toughest thing, and it may happen to a listener who comes in later in the show, it's still a very jarring word. I mean, it's by no means a settled issue whether it's successful at being able to reclaim a word that otherwise is felt so viscerally for a different generation. So it's a very complicated word. But for a number of these youth, it was a fairly important word to take some ownership over.
Let's go now to the thesis of your book. There are a lot of adults today, both heterosexual and homosexual, liberal and conservative, who would assume that an LGBT person in the country has a harder road to hoe than one who lives in the city. Why did you want to take this question on in your research?
You know, I think it was because I kept running up against the ubiquity of that assumption. And I grew up in a relatively small town, and I don't remember in the 80s, I don't remember any clear signal that being in a same-sex relationship, for example, was necessarily a negative thing. It was just that it was not talked about. So that idea of an open secret was the way I understood something other than a heterosexual relationship, for example. So when I moved on to this project, and I had just finished another project about specifically queer identifying political youth activists in San Francisco, I was struck by how many other young people I knew who had moved from small towns to big cities felt the same sort of ambivalence about how unlivable their small town was. And if you look at the literature, for the most part, we've really never asked the question, what is it like in a rural place? We've always assumed that you couldn't possibly have LGBT culture without a city.
And what concerns you about that is that essentially fails to recognize the fact that those experiences in rural communities for LGBT people are every bit as valid or as complete as those of urban dwellers.
Exactly. I mean, for most of the young people I spoke with, they were painfully aware that they were supposed to effectively choose between living in their small town or their gay identity or however they were identifying. So their sense was that it was impossible the two were in commensurate, or that they were working against or diminishing their experiences as LGBT people if they didn't move to a city. So they effectively were being told they were a less than version of that sense of identity.
Mary, are there in fact distinct differences between the way rural youth tend to understand and embrace their sexual identities as compared with urban youth?
I think the primary difference and really the focus of the book is on how much young people in rural communities have to negotiate and prioritize their recognition, their visibility as locals, as somebody's kid, as somebody's relative or lifelong friend. So for these young people who for the most part had no social or economic mobility, they some of them certainly wanted to stay in the country, but a number of them really had no choice. They worked that out by balancing the expectation that locally they were going to be first and foremost backing up their family if they needed additional economic resources in the home, over prioritizing recognition as being somebody different in their community. And for most of their communities, like most urban LGBT communities, their local communities assumed that gay people didn't exist in their town either. So I think it's the biggest difference is the way in which they register and make visible their queerness is fairly different. It can't rely on anonymity or critical mass as it does in cities, and arguably the kind of social safety network that's in place. They really have to rely on being familiar and working with small numbers and working in coalition.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because LGBT youth in rural areas also have to cope with the fact that there are fewer sort of resources available to them within their small towns.
Yes, and they're working within a context in which their communities have fewer resources than urban areas. So, I mean, it very much nests that the lack of social services that we generally see in Appalachia and the region in which I was working, it trickles down. So there's almost no access to safer sex health information at the county level because there really isn't much health information generally that you have to travel a good 2 hours to get to a good size hospital in many of the places that I was working, if not longer. So their communities have such limited access to those kind of social services we assume are just part of the fabric of a city. They're completely absent in rural communities, and that's even more so for rural LGBT and questioning youth.
On the other hand, I think what's really remarkable about this whole thing is the idea that when a small rural area does have activists, they can in fact have a proportionately larger impact on their communities than someone who's living in a city.
Absolutely. I mean, in a town that has maybe two high schools, if a student is able to rally peers and enough family members and you know, allies to form a gay straight alliance or to address training for teachers to get them more aware of LGBT issues, they've literally impacted, you know, generations of students who are going to move through those schools. And it's the kind of impact individual students certainly make in cities, but in terms of how it completely shifts a local conversation, it's so hard to explain, because I think most of us are used to being able to walk out into a protest of 1,000 people and, you know, say hello to our neighbors and walk away. These young people are going into the fray and they never walk away.
Yeah, because public spaces in rural communities are often very different from the ones that we come to expect in cities.
Definitely. I mean, they're using public libraries. They're one of the chapters I talk about how a number of the young people would go to a regional Walmart and do drag in the Walmart as something to, you know, bond and certainly to connect with each other. But it was also a way of being able to create some space for themselves locally. And they effectively make do with what kinds of spaces are available to them in their communities. And because they're community members, they're given room within a certain amount of limitation, but they're given room to take over those spaces and make them their own.
Well, it is sort of a creative understanding of things, because the truth is that is the public square in many small towns.
Definitely. I mean, it's the only place, you know, one of the first questions I asked them was, why Walmart? And they said, well, you know, there's fabulous stuff there to do drag. It's right there in the aisles. But the primary reason was because they're open 24 hours, and there's no place that's available to them with, you know, that they can go to at any time. Otherwise, they're driving to cities that are at least 2 hours away.
Mary L. Gray is my guest. She's assistant professor of communication and culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country: Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. Mary, how significant is the fact that many LGBT kids don't live with a family member who can, from earliest ages, sort of model for them what that actually means?
I think in most cases it means that they fairly early start searching for those reference points. some of them have actually do have that local example. I think the tough thing is that the local example of the bachelor uncle who has a friend who, you know, they've lived together for a long time, that doesn't really resonate or match up with what they'll find in popular media or even going online in terms of, you know, what they're told is I would say, the proper way to be gay, which is to be very declarative and to live a very specific life. So for a lot of them, they fairly early on, because they're saturated in a world that that in which gayness is just a part of what they grow up with now, it's certainly something visible through Will and Grace or other kinds of television programs, they grow up with that kind of visibility in popular media. They know fairly early on that that's perhaps the difference that they feel, and they go online more than probably any other resource now, like their peers, go online to find something that will resonate with their experience of that difference, but in a rural context.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing that you found, because I think a lot of people who would imagine rural kids going online to have these experiences do so because of the anonymity they provide. But in fact, you found that they're using these tools in order to connect locally with others.
I felt like that was one of the most fascinating things that I hope this contributes to media studies and new media studies, particularly, is that we often think of as digital media as a way to escape. It is, you know, nobody knows you're a dog online, is that classic cartoon about how anonymity allows us to pretend to be or to be anything we want to be. For most of these young people, they really are going onto websites and to sites that have coming out stories to connect with other young people, and in most cases, the first thing they do is try to find a young person who's nearby.
Yeah, so these meetings online often turn into a face-to-face encounter.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, they will literally search through chat rooms most chat rooms will have specific regions or cities or locations, and that's one of the first things they do is try and find somebody nearby locally that they don't already know, because I think the assumption is that they already know who else is out there, and they're constantly trying to expand that network.
Another fact that you discovered is that although anti-gay violence in small communities can take different forms than the crimes we see in cities, it isn't proportionally any more common there, which I think would surprise a lot of people.
It's hard because I think we have so many representations of, I mean, the kind of excessive violence, extreme violence that we think of in the case of Matthew Shepard or in the film Boys Don't Cry about Brandon Tina. Our assumption is that it must be horrendous, ugly out in the country. And even thinking of films like Brokeback Mountain, that's incredibly sentimental and beautiful, it paints a horrific picture of violence, and particularly a kind of violence by ones you know. For most of the youth I worked with, they really felt their experiences were so far removed from that horror. And that's not to say those horrors obviously did happen, they do exist, but the tough thing is if we look at hate crimes, and perhaps the hard thing is we don't have federal legislation that tells us how many LGBT hate crimes there are, but if we look at hate crimes, the majority of them are happening in cities, and so many of them are happening to LGBT people of color that go underreported. So I argue in the book that there's really an issue of rather than more or less than, there's a different kind of violence.
Mary L. Gray is my guest. She's assistant professor of communication and culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mary L. Gray. She's Assistant Professor of Communication and Culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back for a minute to this idea of media, mass media visibility. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people sort of applaud the fact that in the past decade or so, mainstream America has seen a lot of much more positive pictures of what it means to be LGBT in America today. But it is interesting that most of these positive portrayals take place in very urban areas. We don't sort of extend the same assumptions to rural America.
I mean, exactly. I think in many cases the assumption is that it takes a city's resources and vibrancy, and again, kind of critical mass to create that sense of community. I think, ironically, most of the representations we have are still fairly one-dimensional. I mean, we still see the character who's there because they're gay, and we don't necessarily get their storyline. Or in other cases, we can see how they fit in perhaps their extended family. I'm thinking of a show like Brothers and Sisters, but we don't actually get to see them moving between that world and a queer world, if you will. So it's very tough for particularly rural kids who are trying to figure out how to make sure their family is a component of their identity, for them to really see anything in popular media that gives some resources for that identity.
Do you think that the urban LGBT community shares some of the blame for dismissing rural life?
Ooh, that's a hard question. Yes and no. I mean, I think yes, through a kind of negligence that was, I don't want to say necessary, but certainly at a time, a critical time in the early 60s to the 70s, when LGBT folks were trying to establish basic human rights, making sodomy laws a thing of the past, or even preventing bar raids, which obviously that hasn't completely been erased. That I know that happened out there in Fort Worth.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things, to make those things happen, to do the kind of social movement work that would mobilize folks to change laws that were incredibly oppressive, I think it took the power of a city. Along the way, we haven't really shifted from Harvey Milk's credo to move to the nearest city. I think the assumption is that we needed to necessarily move away from any sorts of ties that we have of perhaps our given families and move to our chosen families of an LGBT community, and along the way have forgotten that there are folks who don't have that kind of mobility or don't want to have that kind of disconnect from their other senses of identity. So I think some of the issues that happen for rural LGBT youth, arguably the same sorts of priorities for visibility that drive urban organizing, work against LGBT communities of color in the same way. Any sort of politic that assumes that you're not doing it right if you don't first and foremost identify as LGBT isn't recognizing how complicated that identity is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Mary L. Gray about her new book, Out in the Country. Let's go on the line to Jimmy and Alan. Hello, Jimmy.
Hi, Chris. I want to thank you guys for having this conversation.
Sure. It's a
great conversation. My question was to see if there's anything that she found in her studies about how rural gays form their identity. I know a lot of people are used to seeing the gay cliche on TV, and it seems that a lot of them, not too many, but a lot of them do seem to go around this gay cliche idea, kind of like the Jack on mm-hmm. Will and Grace. I myself am from Odessa, Texas, you know, bush country. Mm-hmm. It's very, it's not very rural, but it is a pretty small town. I don't think I came out too much as a gay cliche, but it seems that there are several of my friends who are very gay cliches. What do you think about that?
That's a great question, Jimmy, because I think what fascinated me was how much these folks, the young people I met, ran the gamut So you could, I mean, there were certainly gay-identifying young men who were every, which I consider beautiful, beautiful stereotypes of you know, incredibly flamboyant and, you know, flippish about life. And young women who were, you know, as butch as they could be, but there was everything in between. And I think the tough thing in rural communities, as I think Jimmy was saying, is there's a certain, or perhaps implying that there's a certain kind of expectation of gender normativity, it's called, an expectation that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. So I think within rural communities, young people are always trying to find what's going to balance the expectation of that kind of recognition, of that sort of conformity, with their own desires and interests and how they present themselves in terms of their gender. I thought one of the most interesting cases, a young person named Ashley that I met, and she identified as trans. She was biologically born male. She hadn't taken any hormones. So when I met her, she certainly looked like a young man. But in terms of her identity and her sense of self, she very much identified as female. She, at the same time, felt no need to throw out her love of muscle cars and other, you know, other kinds of things that we would argue are part of a kind of masculine repertoire of gender performance. She felt perfectly comfortable identifying as a trans woman and at the same time retaining these things that she had grown up with, that she didn't see as male or female. She saw them as what she enjoyed.
It would be nice if everyone could get to that.
I agree.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Roy City and speak with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Peter.
Well, I just wanted to thank Mary for coming on the show and opening up the dialogue about this. It's a very important issue, and it's one that I personally deal with. I'm 22 years old and grew up in a very rural town east of Dallas. Had no one to really model my own feelings. Like, I always knew that I was different, but I didn't know, you know, I didn't know in what way until I went to college and got to, I guess, broaden my my horizon of experiences a little bit more and realize that I was gay. And you come back home and tell my mom and dad, and I'm all excited. And you know, it's very difficult in a rural community. And I just wanted to thank Mary for opening up dialogue for sure.
Thanks, Tom. I mean, I think one of the toughest things about this book is that I don't want to suggest that rural communities are free of problems. And what I wanted to be able to present was that there are young people who are crafting ways of being there that are pretty remarkable, and that in many ways we could learn from them in terms of how they work with each other and work with groups that might be hostile to them when they're trying to do this work locally. So, and the other challenge of the book, it's really asking us all to take a pause and think about how identity works, how we come to the identities that we feel so deeply connected to, that, you know, certainly almost all the youth I met thought of their identity, talked about their identity in terms of something inherent, natural, something they were born with. And at the same time, the book offers this snapshot of the very active social construction of the words people were using to describe that difference. And there were some youth who really had a very difficult time feeling that gay matched up. For example, I'm thinking of this one young man, John, who's in one of the chapters, really struggled with identifying as gay because he didn't quite know if he could be gay as he was reading it online and still have fairly different kinds of sexual desires and not being particularly interested in monogamy. I mean, he just didn't, you know, he's almost using gay as a shorthand to kind of compartmentalize or contain all that he, you know, how he could identify. I think that's why queer for some of these young people was very useful.
How different did you find the experience of rural LGBT youth who were comfortable with their sexuality but didn't choose an activist role for themselves within their community?
Mm-hmm. There were a number of young people, because in terms of the strategy for meeting these young people, I really started out asking friends. I was a youth activist, so I had a network of friends who were doing this work in different states, and I contacted friends who are in this region. I said, you know, who are the young people who are active? Who are the ones who are going to Youth Lobby Day and organizing groups in their schools? And I met those young people, and I said, okay, who are your friends? You know, who are you hanging out with? Who's part of your group but not necessarily as active? And there were a good number within that circle who felt certainly a degree of comfort, and for the most part, I think, felt that they had enough support locally, had a sense of what was necessary was effectively for them to be present, and that their presence was their activism. You know, their willingness to talk with other people, their willingness, particularly in their high schools, to talk with their peers about these issues, whether they identified with them or not, was their way of showing their activism. And I think it also is reflective of the kind of subtle, very slow-moving activism that happens in small towns. For the most part, things don't get done by someone getting on the soapbox. Things get done by having a prayer breakfast, by having, you know, a dinner with friends, and a lot of work gets done over years as opposed to over a couple months.
Mary L. Gray is my guest. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. Our email address is think@kera.org. Phone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Sammy in Dallas. Hello, Sammy.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I was just wanting to see if Mary would have some way of applying her research into another broader area. One thing that concerns me both politically and culturally in our country is that so many very families that identify themselves as being very strongly conservative or of a particular religion are fighting so desperately against the rights of the LGBT community. And I was wanting to see if in some way the research could help all of these families understand that the same percentages of LGBT people can be found in all communities, that it's not a matter of us versus them. We are everywhere. And if they're fighting against our rights, they're fighting against their own family members.
Sammy, that's such a great point, because I think in a lot of ways what these young people do are they help their local communities translate that gap. I mean, for most of these communities, again, just like urban LGBT communities, they assume that there aren't, you know, gay people in their town, or certainly enough of them know they're around, but they don't think of them as a constituency locally. So in the book, I talk about this one representative from an area in Kentucky who effectively said to young people who were lobbying him about LGBT student rights that he doesn't have to worry about this because there are no gay people in his district.
As they were sitting there in his office.
As they were sitting there. And he knows these kids. I mean, these are kids he knows certainly members of their extended families. I mean, it's a relatively small area. So his comment that his resistance, his erasure of these young people has everything as much to do with a resistance to certainly his own conservative religious views come into play, but his resistance to seeing gayness as something that could be in his town that's so undermining to his vision of what a small town can or should be. These young people really help their neighbors and their families see what kind of place gayness can have in their communities, that it can be certainly positive because they're important parts of their communities. At the same time, and if there was, I don't want to say blame, but again, if there was a responsibility that LGBT social movement groups need to take up, is that we haven't done anything to show rural communities that we care about their issues. For the most part, we're pretty disparaging. I'm thinking about California's recent campaign around Proposition 8. I'm from California and from the Central Valley of California, which voted overwhelmingly for Proposition 8 in opposition of same-sex marriage. in most cases, those communities hadn't even been talked with by local activists. Nobody was going into those communities and saying, this is why you should care about marriage equality.
Did they sort of write off the fact that they would even consider making a change?
Exactly. I think the view, in terms of advocacy work, it's a waste of time. You know, when we think about political organizing, we often look where we're going to have the, you know, the biggest hit. For Kentucky, they went through this in 2004 with an amendment called Amendment 2 that changed the Constitution and wrote in a union as between a man and a woman. In most cases, it was an amazing campaign in terms of generating awareness and kind of a grassroots network out in rural communities. At the same time, most of the energy and funding was being put into the major cities, Louisville and Lexington, and a couple of smaller cities, because those were familiar territory. We knew who our friends were. We've been much less comfortable actually doing the work of building alliances with rural communities that actually lead with, what do you care about? I mean, if I could on this issue, if we had led with universal health care as an issue, as a social movement, we could have gone into rural communities and said, this is something that affects us all. You know, let's work together on this issue. Marriage equality doesn't resonate in a rural community in the same way that healthcare does. So if we prioritize marriage equality over something that could benefit not just LGBT people in rural communities, but their extended families in that rural community, if we're making those choices, we have to be aware of the limits of then turning to a rural community and saying, hey, you should see the need for backing our rights just because it's the right thing to do.
Did you find people in rural communities tend to maybe embrace the member of their own family who is LGBT, but then still make a different sort of set of rules for everybody else out there?
Absolutely. I mean, that's so funny, Chris, because there were so many times when young people would say, well, you know, my parents don't have a problem with me. They have a problem with gay people. So, yes, all the time.
Mary L. Gray is with us. She's Assistant Professor of Communication and Culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. You can join us by getting on the phone line at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mary L. Gray. She's Assistant Professor of Communication and Culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth, Media, and Queer Visibility in Rural America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Cassie in Carrollton. Hello, Cassie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. You were talking about spreading the word in more conservative areas. I'm a student at CalArts out in Valencia, which is a really conservative town, and I participated in some protests against Prop 8, just holding posters, but I think Valencia still voted majority for Prop 8. So I was curious what kind of advice you would have to kind of spreading the word and getting conservatives more to accept the LGBT community and same-sex marriage.
Hi, Kathy. Definitely one of my hopes for this book is that it's going to offer some examples of how rural organizing might change the work that we're doing nationally and at the state level. So I'd say in most cases, one of the strategies we could borrow from them is to take a long-term approach to what we're doing. I think we often assume that that those who oppose us just if they understood what we were arguing, they'd change their minds. And it doesn't give us an opportunity to really think through how layered and complicated their resistance to recognizing our rights might be, what else might be in the mix. For some conservatives, it's as clear as their sense, their fundamental sense that the Bible is the Word of God, and how they read that word tells them that this absolutely is something they have to stand against. There are certainly others within that mix who might identify as conservative who have a much more nuanced view, and it might have everything to do with this idea that gayness is something that happens in urban cities and we want to keep it at bay. That's a very different sense of why they might oppose gay marriage. So in those cases, the most important thing we can be doing is on the ground meeting, creating opportunities to meet with communities of faith, to build coalitions that really start with that initial move of being willing to listen to something that we completely disagree with. And I think that's an awfully difficult thing for us to stomach, particularly in this day and age, because we almost have examples, you know, if we look at Massachusetts, we have examples where things seem to have just flowed and moved into, you know, a different era and other places that seem so backwards. I would argue it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, we have an email here from Barbara in Arlington who writes, what do you think happened in Iowa, a very rural place that allowed them to support same-sex unions, even though it was decided by the courts, not by popular vote? Everyone I know there has been calmly accepting of the new policy. My theory is that they have had years to think about and miss their family members who moved to the cities.
Oh, that's really beautiful, because I'm sure for a number of people that played into it. Smaller states, and Kentucky was one of them in particular, really worry about what's called brain drain. You know, they see their young people leave for other places because there aren't necessarily economic opportunities. So there's a constant conversation about how can we keep our young people home. And that's certainly true in rural communities, trying to figure out what are ways we can create job opportunities for them that might make it possible for them to stay out in the country without compromising economic stability. So in Iowa, you know, it was a very smart place to take this case because it is a state that doesn't have a referendum system. There's no way for a special interest group to put on a ballot out to the general population and allow them to vote on whether or not that right could be taken away. But particularly Iowa has a long history of being really renegades, being at the forefront of social change. You know, they're the first to integrate their schools. They're the first to do a number of things. So they had that history, and this fits effectively into their history. So I think when LGBT organizers, you know, focused on Iowa, they could tell a compelling story as to why Iowans would want to, if not get behind this initiative. In many ways, it's a very, you know, libertine live and let live move. You know, the Iowan position of, so you want to marry a guy, sure, doesn't hurt me. It works in Iowa. That doesn't necessarily have the same sort of efficacy in a state like Mississippi. It has a different history. It has a different political climate. It has a lot of tension around not just class issues, but race issues. So it's going to have different strategies. And up to this point, we've taken a one-size-fits-all strategy to our political organizing.
I know that your focus in this book is primarily on youth culture, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the phenomenon of older LGBT couples and individuals moving back to the rural areas that they remember from their childhoods or that resemble the places they grew up.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a generation. The generation I was speaking with are probably the first generation who have had fairly early on a sense of their identity. I mean, the average age of coming out at this point is 13, according to a number of studies. So this is really the first generation that's identifying at a point when they still haven't left home. I mean, they're still in this particular environment. They have some time to work it out. And if they have the social mobility, economic opportunity, maybe they're going to move to a small college or a large college and work it out elsewhere. The generation before them, and certainly generations before that, move to big cities. That's what they were told they were supposed to do. I would argue there were probably still folks who stayed behind because they wouldn't have had a choice otherwise. But in terms of the experiences of a large number of LGBT-identifying folks, they left their homes, and now with ailing parents, I saw a number of older LGBT folks in the communities I worked with who were coming home to take care of ailing parents. They are reconnecting with where they grew up. And in a lot of ways, there's probably more room for them to be connected with those families. And it's still rocky, but there's probably more space for them to be back home.
Do you see those adults who are sort of established in terms of who they are, do they have a greater obligation to be very activist in those small communities even than the youth might be taking on right now?
I would argue yes, because in most of these situations, so let me take the case of a gay-straight alliance. It's such an effective strategy. It's something that young people are able to do because constitutionally they can't be told they can't do it. So
let me stop you for one second. Sure. Can you talk about what the Gay Straight Alliance is?
Oh, I'm sorry. So in a number of schools, one way that youth have been organizing in the last decade or so is to create student clubs in their schools, and they're often named Gay Straight Alliances. They're very explicitly named Gay Straight Alliances. And when these first started forming, there was some murkiness as to whether schools had a right to ban a student club that was focused on LGBT issues. So, and I'm of course blanking on the particular year that this happened. There was a court case that judged that gay-straight alliances were protected by the 14th Amendment. That essentially students had the right to form a club regardless of the political or social position it was taking, as long as it wasn't disruptive to the school. So gay-straight alliances have thrived, particularly in California, but in other states as well. They don't necessarily take hold in places that don't have fairly strong histories of student organizing, but in some way, shape, or form, they might form in a high school. The tough thing is that puts all of the expectation and actually the necessity for the young people to do the work on those young people. So as they grow up and leave that high school, it leaves a real deficit for youth leaders to pick up the torch and carry on. If community members, you know, adult community members can be allies to those young people, can advocate, come out to their school board meetings and say, yes, I think this club should be allowed, so that young people don't have to spend so much of their energy making the case as to why they should be allowed, that would go a long way. I mean, I think we have a history within the LGBT community to create a kind of distance between adults and youth. And I was actually part of that generation that believed in youth empowerment, and we were going to be a youth-driven movement. We didn't need older people. You know, anybody over 30 is a suspect. But in this day and age, and I think most of these rural young people get this because they don't have an option, we really need each other. We need to advocate for each other. And again, in the case of priorities, for these young people, marriage is a priority, and at the same time, I think a safer school environment would probably do more for them than anything else.
I wonder if some of that is also changing, that sort of generation gap is narrowing, in part because proportionally so many more LGBT people today have kids than did a generation ago.
Oh, that's an interesting point. I mean, and this is the tough thing. The researcher in me wants to say, you know, we really don't know. We really haven't had the opportunity to rigorously study whether or not LGBT people are having more children, or are we just learning more about them or seeing them more publicly. So I'll go with the assumption that perhaps there are more families forming, definitely in rural communities, having, I'm thinking of this one particular lesbian couple who had moved back to one of the areas I was working, and they have kids in the school. Completely changes the conversation in that classroom, because now the teacher has to deal with the fact that they have parents who are two women, and people talk about their families in these classes. So it brings it to another space for conversation locally. It's not as though people weren't necessarily aware. I think how it gets talked about perhaps has shifted a little bit. In the past, perhaps nobody would talk about that second mom. Perhaps the second mom wouldn't claim to be the parent, would be a friend who lives with the family, and that has changed. I think parents are, I think same-sex parents particularly are much more inclined to be more public about clarifying their relationship to their child in the school to make sure that the school is going to respect their role as parents.
I think another important point that you make here is that it's important not to assume that rural people cannot evolve socially to the extent that they are just as comfortable and familiar with their LGBT neighbors as anybody in the city.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it breaks my heart to think that we are ready to write off whole communities and just assume that they're ignorant, that they're necessarily endemically hostile to us without really looking at what are the points of tension? You know, what is it that allows a mom to say, well, you know, I love my son, but I really don't like gay people? What is it that's being voiced there? And how can we break that down? Can we look at how it's perhaps a sense that gay is equal to a certain kind of middle-class privilege? For a lot of rural communities, they assume that it does mean that you're just flying all over the world, you're buying whatever you want. That's what they see. I mean, that's, you know, it's probably the parallel of when, you know, a show like Dallas gets shown around the world. You
we
know,
hate
what
that
is it
show here.
I bet you do. You know, what is it that people associate with the United States? It's very, very much arguably the same sort of story that, you know, for rural communities, the way LGBT issues have been presented to them has been in a popular cultural context. And there's nothing wrong with those representations, but those are the only representations we have.
I wonder if part of the problem is that media centers are almost exclusively in big cities.
I do think that's part of the problem. I mean, actually, I think in terms of literature, in terms of any cultural production, we really don't acknowledge how unspoken our urban focus is and our exclusion of anything not urban. I mean, perhaps we might include someone who's not from an urban area in an art show, but we certainly don't think that they could produce the kind of caliber of art that a big city is going to create. I mean, we work with the assumption that the urban is the most important place to produce what's on the cutting edge and what's going to be most progressive. And I don't think we have a good reason to assume that, other than that's the kind of expectation and baggage, in some cases, we've put on urban centers. That means that rural communities that perhaps have to work with very little are given fairly little recognition or given a chance to even have the conversation about what they might do with resources, with the LGBT issues.
Ultimately, Mary, do you feel like you wrote this book and conducted this research as much to sort of school urban people as to encourage people who are living in rural areas?
I did. I mean, I honestly, when I started this project, I was coming out of political organizing in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, and I really wanted to talk with my peers who were doing political organizing. We were all kind of struggling with where do things go now? Like, what do we need to be doing? What aren't we doing successfully? And this was really before that deep divide of rural and urban became so obvious with some proposition issues. This became my chance to talk about what we were missing, which is, what does the rest of the U.S. look like?
Mary L. Gray is Assistant Professor of Communication and Culture at Indiana University at Bloomington. Her new book is called Out in the Country, Youth Media and Queer Visibility in Rural America. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.